coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Hello, welcome back. It's time for another Worth Doing Badly here on Lutheran Radio UK. And on today's episode, we will look at the lessons for the 11th Sunday after Pentecost according to Series C of the 3-year Series Lectionary. And the lessons are Isaiah 66, verses 18 to 23, Psalm 50, the first 15 verses, Hebrews 12, verses 4 to 24, and the Gospel according to Luke chapter 13, verses 22 to 30. Taking the lead today is David Weber, followed by comments and questions from Tim Perry.
I think at the center of the gospel lesson is the question that Jesus took from the crowd. And someone asked, will those who are saved be few? Now, I don't know what, we're not told what where the question came from. I don't know if the questioner thought it would that he wanted to be part of the few or he didn't want to be part of the crowd. And what I really like about it is the way that Jesus dismissed it, almost saying, you know, until this moment, I thought the only stupid question was a question that wasn't asked. He says, this is just a dumb question. But his response is, strive. Now, strive is in the plural, so we're still talking about, but he's addressing the crowd saying, here's how you answer a question like that. You strive to enter through the narrow door. There may be few, there may be many, but the entrance in happens to be narrow. Yeah. Now, the imagery is remarkable. That the narrow door, salvation is working through a narrow door. And I know we talked last week, Tim, about how this, therapeutic deism makes believe that everything is wide open and all you do is chill and things just work out. And that's not the universe of the New Testament. New Testament makes it really clear that that your life, if it is not characterized by striving, it is not. You are not really living. Now, let me put it in the context. That sounds judgmental. But I have to say, all the best parts of my life have been living among people who are striving and trying to be better. And by being with them, they make me better. You know, you and I were at Durham at the same time. Being around those kinds of smart people really did help us imagine ourselves as entering into that conversation. And we knew that if we were ever going to talk to those people, we would have to learn a certain vocabulary, we would have to read certain books. And it was not, at least for me, everything came easy for you. But for me, it was a learning curve that that still I have PTSD about. The bit of athletics, I always wanted to be among better people because they make you better. And I still play music. And when I get to play with people who are in, the Boston Symphony and are singing in the highest choirs in Boston, it is inspiring. So when Jesus says strive, I don't hear that as obligatory. I hear that as an inspiring invitation. All right. Now, but no one else did. So when Jesus says this, it's not actually well received. But we do know from the beginning, the truth of salvation is not going to be captured by a survey of majority opinion. Whatever the truth is, it is going to happen. It's going to gain momentum slowly, so the striving is going to have to be continuous. And as we say, it's going to be lifelong. There is no point in the Christian life in which striving becomes marginal or irrelevant. Now, why is this? Because Jesus is saying many, and here you have the crowd will seek to enter and will not be able. And I take this to say we are all agreed about one thing. We want our lives to be better. We want the good things in our lives to last longer. And we want those close to us to become closer. right? Every human being wants, as Plato said, the good life, and the good life is a life that runs deeper and lasts longer than the alternatives. And of course, the New Testament teaches us to think that lasting longer means eternal. So Jesus is saying there is a lot of futility out there. People seeking a life that they are continually disappointed, that the life they desire is leaves them continually begging. And so you get this imagery that striving is not, there is no alternative to striving. People who are not satisfied with the good will continue to striving, but their striving is in vain. Jesus offers us a striving that is not in vain. And it's a striving that actually gets somewhere. But again, somehow I think North American Lutheranism has a lot to say, to answer for, because we have given people the opinion that justification means that striving is irrelevant. No, justification is real. That is really, something is going to radically change at the cross. But that, whatever changes, doesn't change that if you are alive, you are striving. Because anyone who has deep desires cannot just simply be apathetic in this life. Now, why the striving?
Can I jump in and ask a question there?
Yeah.
I wonder how this redounds to the questioner. Are there few that be saved? I wonder if at least part of Jesus's answer is to even ask that question is a distraction from the most important thing.
Oh man, that's exactly right. Because when you strive in vain, you have to distract yourself from the terribleness of your situation. Right. So distraction, as we're finding out now with all the reports about what a cell phone, a life on a cell phone does for you, that's all we're left with. And Jesus says, no, if you actually know that your life is going somewhere, and I think this is the power of forgiveness. If I know that I'm forgiven, then I know that even my striving, which seems to go nowhere, is actually going to be drawn into a pattern of life that does get there, but it's going to get there by grace. So I think, that striving is an act of repentance, but it can only happen if you know that there's the forgiveness in which the striving comes to fruition. So, and here's what I think is the beauty of the general confession of sin. I love the fact that I get to weekly admit to other people that I am a sinner. And the general confession says, I will define sinner. A sinner is someone who routinely impoverishes and makes his life miserable. I, a poor, miserable sinner. And probably, being a sinner means I am impoverishing and making miserable others in my life. We don't admit that once and then, stop admitting it once we get the absolution. We do that routinely, and we're told in catechesis, we do this daily. We remind ourselves. Now, if we really take that seriously, that I am routinely impoverishing my life and making myself miserable, then striving, there is no alternative to striving to be something other than a sinner. And of course, that would be a forgiven sinner, which is not an apathetic sinner, right? It's not an antinomian, which just gets satisfied. So, Now I won't put this in the sermon, but I have to say, because in my own preaching, I have made the mistake of going in the opposite direction, in accenting striving in a way that isn't faithful to the absolution. Those are the Pharisees. And it's remarkable to me linguistically that Pharisee, which was an honorific title, it became synonymous with hypocrite. I mean, that's the power of the New Testament, the linguistic power of the New Testament, so that nowadays we say you're a Pharisee, and everyone knows we're not complimenting you. We are saying that you gave the impression that you were rigorous, but in fact you were hypocrites, and your rigor was just a disguise. And I'm reminded of Augustine's battle with the hyper-rigorous Donatists, in which they They enlarged the catalog of unforgivable sins. And Augustine says, finally, our faith, this striving faith, only is worthwhile because it is, because of this forgiveness, this grace. And now I have a question for you. When Jesus says talks about the futility of striving, he says to them, I do not know where you come from. And I have no idea. He doesn't say, I do not know you, as he does in the parable of the five foolish bridesmaids. He says, I do not know where you come from. Do you know where that comes from?
I have no idea. Enlighten me.
Well, no, I don't. I can't. You would think that AI would have a good answer, but
then I guess we're both hooped.
Okay, so, but I think, I like the idea that it has something to do with movement, right? Mm-hmm. That the movement of your life and where you have come from doesn't make sense to Jesus. Now, we've talked all about the movement of striving, moving forward. Jesus says, no, where you have come from just does not make sense. I don't know you. So, and what happens then is this terrible image. C.S. Lewis says there are two horror themes. You take every horror story, and there are two themes. You are either locked in or you're locked out. And here we have a horror story in miniature, people being locked out because of this inability to understand the place of striving in their life. Now, then you will say, so Jesus expands. Here's how you have come to this. Here's where you have come from. You say to yourself, we ate and drank in your presence, and you taught in our street. And he will say, I tell you, I do not know where you come from. And here Jesus is making a distinction between a disciple and an acquaintance. We all want acquaintances. We're told that the reason why young people today are lonely is because they refuse to make commitments. You can no longer have a party nowadays among young people because that would require the young people to say, yes, I will be there, so that you can order the right amount of food and prepare for the right amount of people. And they don't, young people don't go to parties anymore because they refuse to commit themselves to being in a particular place at a particular time. And Jesus is just saying here, you know, acquaintances are good. They're relaxed. Not having commitment means you can have lots of options on any given day who you want to associate. But what you lose is you are not in real relationship with people. And that is turning out to be the form of despair. We are living in, Jesus says that we are living in a place of weeping and gnashing of teeth. And that's because the things that we have chosen do in fact impoverish us and make us miserable. We cannot get out from the identity of sinners. And the alternative to this are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Those are not three slouches. Those are real characters with real flaws, but you cannot say that any of them were, just were going with the flow. And then Jesus says, and all the prophets of the kingdom of God. Again, what you have are people who were striving, and there's a certain amount of a giddy lightheadedness about the brilliance of these lives. That's why, I find you preach on these lives, and it's inexhaustible. There's just so much to look to, and it's not because they didn't do anything or they were looking for the easy way out. So we're, and the fact is that Jesus could invite us, who are no Abrahams or Isaacs or Jacobs, into this life is, I think it's amazing. All right. Anything more there, Tim? I've probably blown most of the time just on the gospel.
I don't think so. Your last remarks about Lewis and being locked in and locked out I agree with what you're saying, that there is no human life that isn't a striving. The question is what you're striving after. And yet at the same time, I wonder if the questioner's opening question is almost designed to paralyze. I think of my kids who are now, so overwhelmed by the options of late modernity that they can't say yes to anything for fear that they're saying no to something better.
Fear of missing out. Yeah. FOMO.
That kind of figures into what you've been thinking about the gospel or not. But that,
absolutely. But here's my response, is that their outward inability to participate or unwillingness to participate, it then manifests itself in inner anxiety and despair. So the striving is no longer outward. It is in their anxiety, which is terrible. So moving on to the psalm, I just love the fact that El, there's a series of God's name, El, the God, Lord. Robert Alter says he doesn't know it. It's the first time this is in the Psalms. He doesn't see anything like this. But we're supposed to, what the psalm does is figure, it focuses attention on to God. We've been talking about ourselves here, but here's what happens. What the striving does, it gets the attention off ourselves. It takes us off the, what Luther called the incurvatus ense. The fact that what we like is being ourself at the center, being turned in on ourselves. And the psalmist says, no, real life is if you can get that arthritic position, condition in which you're looking at yourself, to get your eyes to look outward and upward at God. And what we see then is that there is in this world a beauty shown forth, and that beauty has its origin in God. And the striving now has, the motivation of striving is not a moral command, but it is the epiphany of beauty. We live in a world that is a passing beauty, but the beauty is all the same. And I just find that the deeper a person has lived, the more they have kind of sucked in the quiddity of life, the harder it is when that life falls. This is why I find a certain kind of despair among Christians, that this great appreciation of the good leads to a deep despair when the good is taken away, and that despair feeds the hope it will be restored. And I think I've said it a number of times. It happens every time one of my dogs dies. It's a terrible couple of months afterwards, because you just recount the goodness of that crazy relationship, and then something happens in which you say, that was a small foretaste of a feast that is coming. So, and here's what the psalmist says. When God is God at his peak, you know, El, God, Lord, when God is who he really is, he manifests itself in coming among us, in gathering us together and not being silent. Now, I find that remarkable, because I don't find anybody coming to church on Sunday awestruck by the beauty of this, but the psalmist is. He said, when God is really God, he is not coming to have a superficial, grandstand, entertainment relationship. He is coming to be among his people so that we can know God and we can be known by God. That's what the gospel is saying. I don't know where you come from. I don't know you. The psalmist has said, if that's true, when God is most God, he isn't answering our superficial questions or giving into our superficial needs. He is coming. He's gathering us together, and he is talking to us. And then you just think, well, that's what synagogues is, the coming together on the way of the assembly. That's what the ecclesia is. And, you know, I have to admit my fault. Rather than feeling terrible about the few people, I've always had small churches. Rather than feeling terrible at that, a gathering of two or three, says the scripture, is itself a miracle and a sign that God is at work. Now, here's what I want to hear from you. That somehow that gathering, that gathering, the psalmist says, he invokes us to hear. He invokes us to pay attention. And I know you've been doing some thinking about attention. What have you come up with here?
My mind is all over the place at the moment. You've kind of struck a vein. I'm not sure where to go. this doesn't quite get to your question, but it's kind of where I'm coming from. As I'm thinking about your reflections on the psalm, which I love, I'm just I'm reminded of my children's talks for the last few weeks. And I actually had someone tell me yesterday, said, your children's talk on Sunday was better than your sermon. but we've been going through the just what makes our church different from other churches. And this past Sunday, I was talking about why I wear the garments that I do and how they're all designed to hide me so that people can see Jesus.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I've got that going on in my head, and I hear you talking about the psalm, and I think, man, so many of, at least the people where I'm ministering, and I think it's because I'm in the buckle of the Canadian Bible Belt, the people where I'm ministering think church is a free gathering of people to sing some songs to make them feel better, to hear a TED talk about God or spirituality, and then to go out for brunch.
Don't get rid of the brunch. I agree with that part.
Well, I just think that that's where a lot of people are coming from, and I think they'd be really surprised, and this is why I keep harping on it even in my children's talks. They're really surprised that we don't gather on our own. We are called by God to meet with God, to be healed and redeemed by God through the ministries of word and sacrament.
Yeah,
that's what it is, right? And so that's just where when you're expounding on the psalm, it's really resonating with me.
Okay, so here's the problem I see is that I would have in almost every meeting, people would always say, why can't we have the attractiveness of, and they would point to some mega church down the road.
Yeah.
Right? And the psalm answers it. It's because in a mega church, you have acquaintances, you are not getting intimate. Now, I'm not sure that that's a fair assessment. I'm just saying that the more that worship becomes entertainment, the less it becomes edifying. And what God doesn't want to entertain us. He wants us to get intimate with him, and so that we know him, that we know where he's coming from, and that he knows where we have come from. So I just really love the idea, and I love it because it is proving true. I'm 70 years old. It's proven true in my life that the things that have really mattered are not the high moments of entertainment. The things that really matter is a lifelong attention to this, to the Gospels, to the life of Jesus. And of course, it sounds like I'm a paid witness, but the fact is, it's true that this thing has done what I didn't expect, but it actually happened in being, in some weird sense, satisfying. That it has been the filling that has granted the fullness I have desired, which is why I love the word fulfilling. What a great mashup of, you know, adjective and verb. So, and the reason why it works, the psalmist says, for God says, the world is mine. You know, this is my world. It's not your world. Don't you think that, I'm going to keep you hungry. I'm not going to satisfy you in a way that would make you content with this world. I will satisfy you in a way that makes you hungry, that this world lives eternally. And then what I really like is at the end, the psalmist makes it clear that part of the whole thing, part of the miracle of that gathering where God is present is that people will really want to thank God. They will, whatever their complaint, the language that defines them will not be complaint. It will be thanksgiving. It will have some complaints, as the psalmist teaches us, but it will be characterized by thanksgiving. And that thanksgiving will happen only because, the psalmist says, on the day of distress, deliverance has taken place, right? I will free you and you will revere me. That is all we can promise. We cannot promise to free them from distress. We can only promise them that when the distress happens, it will unfold, and in the end, you will want to gather again among the ecclesia and give thanks and revere God. All right. I am going to just make one small a point here. The psalmist says that we are to struggle against sin. So it goes back to striving. Read the epistle to better understand. It unfolds beautifully in telling us more about what it is that striving involves, and so that is a tremendous unfolding. Again, more material than any single sermon could ever deal with. And so I guess we will just leave the Old Testament for people to do on their own.
Thank you, David, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.